Dear friends, I'm very glad to be here. My name is Fyodor Wojtylowski. I'm Deputy Director of the Institute of World Economy and International Relations of Russian Academy of Sciences. I'm very grateful to Middlebury College, Monterey Institute, and especially to Anna Vasilieva for inviting me to have this opportunity to give lectures to you and to talk about the topic which I'm thinking about for last, I think, 15, 16, something like this years. I'm in this business from 2001. I have graduated Moscow University Department of History in 2001. I'm by my regions, I'm historian. I used to be a historian until I decided to go to study as a PhD student at IMMOR, at the institute I'm working right now. And there they told me that now you're becoming a political scientist. I see no difference, honestly, because historians are analyzing the past, analyzing how and explaining how events could happen and has happened and have happened, and political scientists are and analysts in the sphere of international relations are explaining the current events and forecasting how they could develop in the future and how the international system and the behavior different actors of the international system can and will develop. So another difference between historians and political scientists are is, to my mind, in the attitude towards sources and what we are using as sources for our analysis. But the reality we're analyzing is the same. Historians are more oriented to the past, and we are more oriented to analyze the current situation and to forecast the future. So I did my PhD in international relations. From the beginning, I'm a specialist in the U.S. foreign and security policy. I'm writing mostly about U.S. foreign and security policy and transatlantic relations, but I think since 2007 or 2008, before Barack Obama has started his Pacific pivot, I have started to analyze U.S. foreign policy in Asia Pacific. So today I will try to continue the line which my friend and colleague Matt Rozhansky has started in his lecture, in his brilliant lecture, I would like to add, about the Cold War and about, you know, things we can use to things and you know, we can explain and events that we can explain interconnect with the concept of Cold War in the past, and why we're using this metaphor to analyze Russian-American relations right now, and what is correct and what is incorrect in the using of this metaphor to explain the new system of relations which is emerging between Russia and the United States. What is different from the Cold War period and relations from the Soviet relations between the Soviet Union and the United States, and what is the same or comparable? From the beginning, the word small amendment. I was strongly criticized for wearing a tie today. I promise that it's the first and last time I'm wearing tie lecturing here, and I understand it's my second time in California and second time in Monterey, and you know, I understand that Californian style of behavior, of outlook, is a little bit different from Moscow or Washington, D.C., and I promise not to break rules here. So I apologize for my outlook, and I want to go further without these formal, you know, elements of expertise. So from the beginning, the world the word Cold War have been used as the metaphor for understanding and explaining relations between Soviet Union and the United States and also Great Britain in 1940s, and in the political usage, it has been used for the first time by Bernard Baruch, famous American politician, banker, and diplomat, but in 1947 to explain relations between states which have been members of anti-Hitler coalition and the nature of their relation. He explained the nature of their relations after the end of the Second World War and how it was dramatically spoiling. But originally, the first usage of this metaphor to explain relations between Soviet Union, Great Britain, and the United States has been used by famous writer George Orwell. In 1947, just two or three months before Bernard Baruch used it in one of his speeches, George Orwell wrote an essay in which he described a situation in the relations between former anti-Hitler coalition members as the Cold War. Since that time, this metaphor, which is of course not a scientific term, has been used as an instrument of analysis and explanation of relations between two superpowers. Relations between two superpowers, Soviet Union and the United States, from the beginning were highly dependent on the ideological background which two countries had from their region in their development. And the legacy, the ideological legacy of the Cold War in some elements is still existing. And I will try to explain why it is still existing, even taking into account that we do not have ideological struggle right now between Russia and the United States. I describe ideology, it's my definition, as system of ideas, beliefs about goals, principles, and models of organizations of functioning and development of the society and its political, economic institutions and moral practices aimed to change it and social and political, and to change it and social and political environment around it. From the beginning, both American version of liberalism and Soviet version of communist or socialist, radical socialist ideology have been aimed not only to develop the society, not only to develop and to liberate the outlook and model of behavior of state and its institutions, model of economic system, but both of them were, they had a goal of transformation of the world around them. It differs them from even from ideologies which have been developed in Europe after the era of Enlightenment, French Revolution and everything like that. Because these ideologies have been strongly interconnected with the idea of nation state and in its European understanding, and with European understanding of Europe-centered international system. What has changed with the development of American liberalism and Soviet communism after the First World War? Development of these ideologies have been deeply interconnected with development of two states which had motivation to not only to be the experiment of transformation of the society, system of values, economic model, political system, but have been aimed to transform other systems, other states, other countries, other nations, by the principles which they were presenting by their existence. It's very significant to understand this role of ideas and beliefs of Soviet and American political elites to explain the model of relations between two countries which have been developed after the Second World War. Because during the Second World War, the role of two countries which used to be peripheral to the Europe-centered international system changed dramatically. And this role have been based, this new role, emerging new role, have been based on two factors. European, continental and colonial empires were in the end of their decline. They were declining and still declining, and because some elements of European empires are still existing in current international system. But after the Second World War, the decline of empires has gone to the phase which I can describe as the last phase of decrease of European and colonial and continental empires. Both of these countries, Soviet Union and the United States, during their history before this period, have been developed as parts of empire, empires or as empires like Russia, continental empire. But after American Revolution and after Russian October Revolution, both of the countries, both of these countries have become motivated with anti-imperial goals and have become motivated with anti-imperial understanding of international system. The paradox is that this anti-imperial motivation led to the development of the strongest superpowers, which in their nature have a lot of elements of imperial statutes, imperial understanding of their values, geopolitical influence, spheres of influence, relations with neighbors, allies, partners, and other countries. But at the same time, both the United States and Soviet Union have been developing as countries based on the ideological and political experiment, changing the nature of imperial behavior and aimed to change not only the surrounding, not only countries around them or having colonies in other parts of the region. Both of them were aimed to change the world order in general. The nature of state, the nature of society, economic, political, and social background of other countries by the example of their own country, and to change the world order in general, relations between countries, international system in general. So these two superpowers, they have developed a system of relations, system of relations which have been based on the understanding of their new role in the international system. And if you will read attentively, for example, protocols of Yalta, of Tehran, Yalta, and Potsdam conferences, you will see that even taking into account that there are three countries, United States, Great Britain, and Soviet Union, talking about the world order and its institutions, its organization, its future development. The role of two countries, two most significant powers who received unique positions in the international system, the Soviet Union and the United States, because of the Second World War and after Cold War, is decisive in this, you know, this in this discussions about the outlook of international system. Cold War has started as the system of competition, cooperation, and a balance of power between two super emerging superpowers. Why I use the word cooperation? Because developing conflict between the Soviet Union and the United States, both sides received not only influence in former spheres of influence of European colonial and continental empires in Europe, in Asia Pacific, and in other regions of the world. Both of them received an opportunity to develop such model of world order in which they can play a decisive role, which no one could divide with them. And that's the paradox of this system. Any conflict you are having is not only limiting opportunities for both sides of the conflict, it is also giving an opportunity to expand their influence. Because if strong powers and USSR and the United States after the Second World War became stronger, not weaker, stronger military, stronger economically, stronger politically and ideologically. So the start of the Cold War in 1940s gave them an opportunity to become, you know, the major stakeholders of the international system. And development of their capabilities, especially military capabilities, development of their ideological influence, development of their political influence was the factor which not only motivating and moving countries to the conflict against each other, but the conflict in general gave them opportunities to reach the new role in the world, and that's what's significant. What was the psychological meaning of the Cold War for both countries? And it's very significant because psychology, economy and military issues have become principal to analyze and to understand the development of Cold War world order, and to understand how it is still influencing and how the Cold War world order is having inertia influencing on current international processes, which are very different by their nature, but still having in common many with the previous international system. I already described you an ideological motivation and ideological background for two countries and two emerging superpowers and to their for their elites, but very significant factor is from the beginning, ideological issues, ideas, beliefs, and values, motivating not only domestic political development, but also foreign policy, security policy, relations with other countries. All of them have become significant factor of domestic political development, significant factor of the transformation of way of thinking and behavior of political elites of both countries. And this factor was getting stronger and stronger during the period of the Cold War, even taking into account that, of course, the motives of political elites are always rational. This rationality develops in a very different cognitive and psychological environment. And from the beginning, in the world order of Cold War, this environment have been strongly influenced not only by domestic political goals, but it has been strongly influenced by the competition and conflict between two superpowers and ideologies they were representing on the global arena. This is significant to understand the way of thinking, the way of understanding the world, which the psychology of both Soviet and American political elites have been based. I understand that for American political culture, it is not common to describe American system of beliefs and system of values as ideology. I understand that Karl Mannheim, famous political scientist, explained all systems of beliefs and systems of ideas as ideologies which are blinding nations and societies and not based on rational understanding of the system. And many people in this country are believing that they have rational understanding of international system and of motivation of behavior of other countries. But at the same times, I'm sure that many scientists and political scientists and analysts in this country will agree that American foreign policy is strongly ideologically driven. Like, and especially it was strongly ideologically influenced, especially during the Cold War. And each time you are talking about democracy, you're talking about values, you're combining values and interests in your analysis, you're approaching to the international system with ideological understanding of the development of the society and of the international system. There is nothing bad in it. There should be an element of your analysis and of your understanding of motives of both sides during the Cold War. Both sides were rational in their own rationality, based on ideological understanding of the world and relations between each other. What was second very significant impact of the Cold War on the way of thinking and way of understanding of the world of Soviet and American political elites? I can describe it with the term securitization of minds of American and Soviet political elites. From the beginning of the Cold War, the possibility of military conflict in that time was very high, especially in Europe. You remember Berlin crisis, you remember how emerging superpowers were struggling for spheres of influence in Europe. You remember that there were a lot of Soviet troops standing in Europe, and there were a lot of American troops standing in on European ground after the Second World War. Even taking into account that from 1945 till 1948, the number of Soviet and American troops in Europe was reducing, and military spendings of both countries also have been reducing. The probability of direct conflict, especially in Europe, has become one of the principal drivers of understanding of behavior of the other side, understanding of motives and goals of so-called major adversary, главный противник, like they say it in Russian. And another theater of possible direct military conflict in that time was Asia-Pacific. And I want to remind you that conflict in Korea has dramatically changed, even more significantly changed, nature of Soviet-American relations than situation in Europe. Because after the Second World War, Soviet Union and the United States, they had a sort of consensus about which country is going to one sphere of influence and which is going to another. Of course, we had Greece and Turkey precedent and Marshall Plan and Soviet decision to change governments in Eastern European countries. But in general, situation, military political situation in Europe has been stabilized. But in Asia Pacific, both countries, together with processes of decolonization, together with degradation of spheres of influence of former European colonial empire, saw an opportunity to expand the influence of their own ideas, of their own spheres of influence and military political presence. And war in Korea was a decisive factor for the United States, for example, to change dramatically the numbers, the figures of military expenditures. The same thing happened with the Soviet Union. For example, in 1949, the figure of the military budget of the United States has been approximately in current US dollars about 109 billions of US dollars. Soviet military budget in the same time was 113 billions of US dollars. I'm using current US dollars to better explain the numbers. In 1953, after more than less than 5 years, in 4 years, the figure of American military budget became 544 billions. So it grew five times in 4 years. Soviet military budget in the same period became about 365 billions of current US dollars. I want to remind you that the labor force in Soviet Union was much cheaper than the United States. So figures, they are comparable. And in many economic aspects, these figures are comparable. In 1950s, the role of direct military conflict between the United States and Soviet Union was principal for both sides to for understanding intentions of the other side, because both countries had an experience of Second World War. Both countries have seen and illets, because there was the same people who were fighting during the Second World War and developing economy and influencing on political system and having their careers during Second World War. They had the same experience and they had the same understanding of the high possibility of conflict. What has become another factor of securitization of mind? The development of nuclear weapons. When both countries received and capabilities of having a strategic nuclear forces which can be used during the conflict on regional level or on global level, and they have been developing these capabilities. These capabilities have become the factor which is influencing not only understanding of military theory, not only understanding of strategic goals of your adversary, but at the same time, it has become a factor of psychology of elites. Since both countries have been reaching an opportunity to use this strategic nuclear forces to reach the territory of your principal adversary, major adversary, they received an instrument which at the same time have been has been motivating them to think in the in very global categories, but at the same time reducing their opportunities and reducing their motivation of real towards real military conflict. And this factor has become very, very strong factor of development of psychology of generations of people who have been involved in the Cold War system. And I am very glad that my friend and colleague Dr. Rajansky used the word generation, and has attracted your attention to this you know, issue of changing of generations, because from the beginning of the Cold War to its end, several, I think, three generations of people with different political experience, different psychology, and different understanding of the world around them have been involved into the global competition and confrontation between the Soviet Union and the United States. The first generation of people who had the Second World War experience on high command positions and who have started the Cold War because they saw the opportunity of direct military clash, and they were understanding the world around in the categories based on this opportunity of direct military clash. The second generation who received their status, career, their education and the practical experience during the first phase of Cold War, which was very hot and very intense in terms of the speed of competition and in terms of competition not only in military, technological and military political sphere, but in terms of competition, a competition for spheres of influence, which have been opened after the collapse of colonial empires, and when competition for the world for the third world has started. Cold War practices of struggle for spheres of influence between USSR and the United States in Europe in 1940s, in Asia Pacific in 1950s and 1960s, in the Middle East in 1940s, 1970s, in Africa and Latin America in 1960s and 1980s, helped to develop global strategic thinking. It's the unique phenomena of the Soviet Union and the United States, the global strategic thinking. Yes, in previous eras, in previous periods of world history, different nations have received opportunity to influence of the major part of Oikumena, for example, Roman Empire in the ancient times, France, Great Britain, and in some aspect Germany in the era of early capitalism, and together with this opportunity to have impact on the international system, the strategic thinking based on the a universal understanding of goals and of instruments you can use to receive your status, opportunities, influence, and other benefits have developed. But status and influence, and which Soviet Union and the United States have received during the Cold War, was unique in their practical experience, because both countries they had a global vision, global goals, and global understanding of the practices they can use to receive these goals and benefits. It has started in security sphere, but it also involved economic thinking, It also involved political thinking and understanding of political processes in other countries and regions, because it was zero-sum game, and if you were not winning, somebody else, your major adversary, could win and will win if you will not try to win. So it was, you know, the principal background of relations and principal background for strategic thinking of both political elites, Soviet and American. Another phenomena, which I mean psychological and social political phenomena, which has been developed because of Cold War and during the Cold War, is the phenomena of groups of interests inside political elites of both countries, which have been motivated and strongly inspired by the opportunities which Cold War confrontation, military confrontation, economic competition, technological competition, and competition in the sphere of ideas and values gave them, and with experience and opportunities they could receive because of the Cold War. I call them with a term which has been developed and suggested by American political scientist John Donovan, Cold Warriors. So during the Cold War, we had three generations of Cold Warriors. And each one had, of this generation, had its own experience of the development of international relations, and each of them had experience of bilateral relations with the major adversary, because, for example, the experience of people who has started Cold War was highly dependent on their previous experience in the of the period between two world wars and after the during the Second World War and after Second World War. The mentality and way of thinking of second generation of Cold Warriors was highly dependent with the development of phenomena of military-industrial complex and economic and political practices of relations between Soviet Union and the United States, and development in 1960s, 1970s, and development of the international system based not only by not only on principles of confrontation, but also on the development of the third force in the international system, which emerged and developed because of stabilization of the system, and this stabilization has been received because of strategic stability in the nuclear sphere. And this phenomena of third force can be explained with, for example, detente in Europe, development of social democracy in European countries, development of non-involvement movement, движение неприсоединения, in the Third World War, in the Third World, and development of different forms of liberal opposition inside both system, inside Soviet system and inside American system. I mean liberal opposition which has been integrated into the system. People who were thinking in more practical categories and were understanding clearly what could be the result of direct military clash between two countries. These groups have developed both in the United States, and they influenced not only on the public level, but also on a very high political level. They influenced on decision-making process. I can give you an example of detente in Europe, but there are also lots of examples, the end of Vietnam War, and many other things. In Soviet system, these people also appeared because of stabilization of the conflict between the Soviet Union and the United States, and because of opportunity of massive assured destruction. When both countries received such level of development of strategic nuclear forces and capabilities, not only to damage military systems and military industrial capabilities of other country, but to destroy the whole planet, to destroy human civilization, a lot of people on both sides inside political systems understood the stakes of direct military conflict. And these people appeared in Soviet system, in the military sphere, in political sphere, in the expert community. And they highly influenced on the behavior of Soviet system. I know what I'm talking about because I read a lot of memoirs, especially focused to find out the influence of this group. And I belong to, and I work for the institute, which has appeared in the period of Khrushchev's Otepel, when Soviet government wanted to have a more comprehensive understanding of the world around, and understood that information which can be provided by Ministry of Foreign Affairs, by military and political intelligence, is insufficient to understand deep processes developing in world economy and international system. From the beginning, the institute which I'm working for has become an alternative voice inside the system. It has been integrated to the system and influenced on decision-making process, but it has become an alternative voice, and it suggested political alternatives, other ways of understanding of international relations also with the United States. And this institution was not unique, because under the auspices of Russian Academy of Sciences, there were other institutes aimed to analyze and to explain the Western world, like Institute of US and Canada, led by famous Georgi Arbatov, and other institutes and think tanks giving ideas to Soviet government and to Central Committee of the Communist Party, how to explain, how to understand the world, what to do in the world, what can be dangerous, what can rise risks, and what could be the stakes. The same thing was happening in the United States, and it led to the stabilization of relations between two superpowers. As I explained before, large groups of interests inside two countries, inside the political and economic system, have been developing under the influence of the phenomena of Cold War. They have been involved there into this struggle, not only with their interests, but also with their social status, because institutions they were working for, creating, and institutions and practices influencing of on their lives were interconnected with the Cold War. Development of strategic offensive forces of both sides at the same time was strongly militarizing the way of thinking, the theory and practice of international relations, but at the same time it has been stabilizing the system, because it has been showing limits to the conflict and limits to the opportunity of usage of military means to receive political goals. And this is very significant. What was another practical result of stabilization of relations between the Soviet Union and the United States in 1960s, 1970s, on the fact that they can eliminate, that the two countries can eliminate each other and civilization on the world on Earth, was the opportunity for them to not to be involved directly into conflict against each other. The experience of Korean War and experience of Vietnam War gave you know, a lot of opportunities to use, for example, nuclear weapons, but they didn't use it because they understood the stakes. But there were discussions on both sides about the possibility of limited usage of nuclear weapons. But it also gave an opportunity for development of the phenomenon of proxy wars, which Dr. Rozhansky described before, and which is still existing in the world. When countries, in this case superpowers, are becoming indirectly involved into the conflict, with supplying arms, supplying economic aid, giving expertise, giving you know, some human resources, but not to the countries or to the forces inside countries involved into direct military clash and military conflict, but not becoming directly involved into this conflict because both sides are understanding the stakes. This phenomena developed under the auspices of the Cold War and experienced many times in many countries of the world. Most of us have heard about Korea, about Vietnam, about Afghanistan, but only specialists know about wars in Nicaragua, in Ethiopia, in Tanzania, in Mozambique, in many other countries where Soviet Union and the United States have been indirectly involved into a proxy conflict, supporting and supplying different sides of the conflict inside these countries. These practices were very significant for understanding not only the struggle for spheres of influence, but also for understanding the ideological influence and the role of a communist and liberal ideology and a system of values and beliefs and its influence on development of different parts of the world and international relations. You know, in Soviet system, there was a big problem in explaining some processes developing in the third world because it was easy to say that this country is becoming communist. But if it is becoming communist, what should we do? Should we integrate it into Warsaw Pact and give guarantees of security? And should we involve it into Soviet economic bloc, which has been called Council of Economic Mutual Aid, Совет экономической взаимопомощи, and if we integrate this country into this economic bloc, what should we do? Should we pay for loyalty of this government? Should we give serious programs of economic aid? What should we do? The same problem was for the United States in many regions, because in the beginning of the Cold War, the United States tried to have different regional military political blocs with opportunity to develop economic ties. But then US government has become disappointed in these practices and decided not to support blocs in peripheral blocs in many parts of the world and to spend money on the governments which are unpredictable and which can involve the United States into direct conflict with the Soviet Union. The same was with Soviet Union. And Soviet ideologists in the Central Committee of the Communist Party developed the special term, countries of socialist orientation. So it means that these countries are not receiving an opportunity to become members of Communist Bloc, Warsaw Pact, or Council of Mutual Economic Aid, but they are receiving an opportunity to be involved inside this community with some ties, with some forms of light integration. The same thing happened with the United States and its allies, allies and partners around the world. There were partners with no trade obligations, and there were partners with no security obligations or limited security obligations. And this system, which has developed during the Cold War, has been destroyed after 1989 in the socialist camp. And now we do not have Warsaw Pact. We do not have Council of Mutual Economic Aid. But what we still have is a system of military obligations which the United States are having under the auspices of NATO and firmed with Article 5 of Washington Treaty. And at the same time, a system of obligations towards Japan, South Korea and other countries, Pakistan, for example, which the United States are having, which is different, but which is also the system of military obligations which emerged and developed during the Cold War. Russia is having a sort of, imitation of a military pact with Central Asian countries and Belarus, called Organization of Collective Security Treaty, but it is incomparable with Warsaw Pact, because Warsaw Pact was comparable with NATO, as Matt mentioned before, in terms of military capabilities, including conventional military capabilities and strategic military capabilities, because Soviet troops were standing in eastern Germany, and for them to receive the bank of the canal and to get in front of British territory could take from 4 to 6 days. From 4 to 6 days to conquer the whole Europe, even taking into account the opportunity of usage of tactical nuclear weapons, because there were different scenarios during Second World War of conflict in Europe, and some of them did not include the massive usage of strategic nuclear forces and exchanges between the United States and the Soviet Union with fatal strikes on the territories of each other. But for example, there were scenarios of limited war in Europe with the possibility of usage of conventional and nuclear weapons used, tactical and especially tactical nuclear weapons used as a normal instruments of military war, of military conflict, together with conventional weapons. What is in common and what is different to the current international system, or the international system we're entering right now, and the system of Cold War? And what is different? Here I can suggest you some tables. I'm not sure that they are generalizing everything I would like to say and to describe these international systems and the major factors which have been using, have been influencing on their development. But what is different? What is significantly different is the role of leading actors. So the role of Soviet Union is incomparable to the role of Russia in the international system. It is incomparable economically, it is incomparable politically, and it is incomparable ideologically, because Soviet Union has been developing as a country aimed to transform the world, aimed to transform other societies, other countries, to spread communist ideology, to spread socialist model of economic system and political system. Russia is different. Russia is not trying to insist that the model we are having now can be used for any other country. Russia, at the same time, is trying to copy some elements, some practices, some institutions of Western democracies, including the United States. I can give you one example. When in 1990s, there were, and after the end of the Soviet Union and after transformations of Russian political system has started, there were discussions about the model of Russian democracy. And many people inside Russian political elite supposed that presidential, a strong presidential power copied or took by analogy from the United States can be better for Russia than a parliamentary model of democracy. And can give more opportunities for control because such a big country, and can give the better political system, which is you know, which could be more sufficient for the tasks of development and transformation of Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Structure of world economy. During the Cold War, in the initial period of Cold War, and during different phases of its development, what was significant and what was changing inside both system and relations between them was growing economic interdependence. A lot of people are thinking that Soviet system was and socialist camp was something very different from world economy and was separated from world economy at all. That's not true. If you look attentively to the figures of trade, to the figures of involvement into different economic practices, including investment and development of TNCs, which have also developing on, but under the state control in the socialist system, you will see that step by step, during especially during 1960s and 1970s, especially with Western European countries, socialist countries, especially socialist Eastern European countries, have becoming more and more engaged economically into more and more ties with Western major economies and with and through developing world with countries of the world periphery involved into also involved into emerging international economic interdependence. The level of necessity of trade, of mutual trade, of receiving investments and credits from the Western community was growing strongly during 1970s and 1980s and influenced strongly on the motives of decision-making bodies, not only in Soviet Union, but also in other socialist countries. The period of détente in 1970s gave the unique opportunity for economic ties between Soviet Union and Western European countries, between Eastern European countries and Western European countries, to establish economic ties and to development practices of mutual economic activities. And it has become very interesting and not really studied factor of transformation of the international system. I have a friend who is now Deputy Director of Institute of World History of Russian Academy of Sciences, Mikhail Lipkin, and he wrote a brilliant book about economic ties between socialist economic bloc, organization of mutual economic aid, and EU in 1960s, 1980s. And he, with many arguments, many sources and many figures, he argues that the level of stretching and moving economic interdependence was slightly step by step transforming motives of decision making in the socialist camp, including Soviet Union. But what we have now, we have absolutely different world in terms of economy. We have globalized international system. Russia is the part of its globalized international system. And what are the United States are trying to do when they're using sanctions against Russia? They are trying to limit the level of integration of Russian economy into globalization processes. And they're trying to have impact on the development of different spheres of Russian economy, which are most integrated into the globalized international economic system. That's the paradox. And this thing differs also current period with the Cold War. Military balance. Emergence of strategic stability as the opportunity for both sides to destroy each other has become a very significant factor of zero-sum equilibrium based on the hypothesis of mutual assured destruction. Why hypothesis? Because nobody tried to receive mutual assured destruction, and nobody knows on which step of escalation of the conflict the country and the political elite can stop during the direct military clash. What we will do, because, you know, Minister McNamara tried and the groups of experts working for him tried to develop the theory of flexible response, when each step of escalation of direct military conflict can be the final and will not lead to another step of higher escalation and can give opportunity for sides to have some talks or to stop the conflict. But nobody proved ever if it will work or not. The same thing with mutual assured destruction. In the case of direct military conflict, not Soviet Union and not the United States ever tried to check on which step their major adversary will stop during the direct military conflict. Should we use all capabilities or should we use part of them? You know, there were two groups in the 1960s trying to elaborate a theory of motives and of behavior of other side during direct military clash with nuclear weapons, and they tried to develop criteria of winning or losing in the nuclear war. And I'm not sure that any of this group, not Soviet, not Americans, succeeded. But Americans, they suggested that destruction of 65% of military forces and about 40% of Soviet industrial infrastructure will lead to the hypothetical opportunity to win in the direct military conflict with usage of nuclear forces. Soviet experts suggested to Soviet government absolutely different approach. They suggested the hypothesis about changes of behavior of decisive bodies of the United States in military and political sphere after the destruction of three, four major cities of the United States. the destruction of because of democratic political system and because of democratic political processes by the opinion of Soviet military experts in that time could lead to the end of the war because in case if cities like New York, Los Angeles, Washington DC, Detroit and others could be destroyed, San Francisco, because for the Soviet Union even destruction of Moscow could not be fatal, because Soviet territory gives, as they thought in that time, in that time, it's not me thinking in these categories, but Soviet territory and the development of economic and political system could give alternatives to Moscow in case of destruction of Moscow, and could be supported with alternative capitals. What has become criteria for stabilizing international system, and what has become a result, a practical result of stabilization of Cold War system in 1970s? The Tant process and stabilization in Europe. Development of arms control system, which was very significant result of the Cold War, because arms control system was not only the phenomena of Soviet-American bilateral relations. The arms control system gave Soviet Union and the United States moral, political, and technical instruments to influence on the development of nuclear capabilities of third countries, of third sides, including allies of both countries, and including other countries not involved in any sort of alliances with Soviet Union and the United States. I can give you two examples. The United States strongly influenced on the development of British nuclear capabilities, and in some period the United States has supported development of these capabilities, but in some period it stopped the development of technical and technological development of British nuclear capabilities. The same thing in the socialist system. When Romania was developing military nuclear program, Soviet Union strongly influenced and forced Ceausescu's regime to stop it. The same thing Soviet Union tried to do with China, but it resulted into the conflict between Soviet Union and China in 1960s. Soviet Union tried to reduce development of North Korean nuclear capabilities, and North Korea had cooperation with Romania in socialist camp, which was a sort of conspiracy against Soviet influence on and Soviet activities of non-proliferation of nuclear technologies inside Soviet system. There is also another example. Soviet Union wanted, if Soviet government in some period wanted to have nuclear allies inside Warsaw Pact, and it has suggested to Hungary to has strategic aviation, but Hungary refused. it's another example. But anyway, this system of arms control was not only the result for relations between two superpowers, it had very strong global impact on the development of international system, security system and arms control. So during the period after the end of the Cold War, I have described several of these factors, but what has become significant and what has become decisive for understanding current relations between Russia and the United States were not only dramatic changes in the nature of state and political system of Russia, which differs it strongly from the Soviet Union. It was also factors of economic interdependence, which I mentioned, and which led Russia towards its current trends of development of economic system, because if it will be in crisis in the future or not, if it will be more governmentally controlled or more liberal in its nature, if it will be more oriented on domestic economic development or more oriented on the development of Russian transnational private enterprise. In any case, Russian economy is not separate anymore from global trends, is not separate anymore from global economy, from world economy as a general interdependent global system. And that this is changing dramatically current Russia from the Soviet Union. And it also dramatically dramatically differs motives and way of thinking and understanding of the world of Soviet elite and current Russian elite. Because Soviet elite, in any case, even Soviet economic elite, was has been driven by motives of political goals, military goals, and ideological goals, much less than economic motivation. Current Russian political elite is complete economic animal. Of course, it can think in the categories of spheres of influence. It can think in the categories of military security, in or in more traditional political understanding of the world. Even it can have elements of some ideological structures in the way of its thinking, but it is motivated and driven by economic motives. It looks to be interdependent with the world economy. It looks it looks for Russia being engaged into global economic ties, and it wants to be integrated into the global social economic system of division of labor, and it is looking for the place of Russia in the global economic system. This is differing significantly way of thinking and way of behavior of current Russian elite from Soviet political elite. Balance of power. In terms of balance of power, figures are also incomparable, because nowadays Russian military budget is 10 times, more than 10 times, less than US military budget. It is more significantly about 13 times less than military budget of all NATO countries. Of course, the role of the United States there is decisive, because 600 billions of US military budget are still incomparable with 290 billions of military budgets of European members of NATO. But now it is incomparable with Russian military capabilities in the conventional sphere, and the Russian military technology and the Russian spendings on military security. What is comparable and what is the same, but of course in absolutely different figures, is the strategic stability and nuclear capabilities of Russia and the United States. Because both countries are still having the unique opportunity and unique capabilities to destroy each other completely. both countries are still having nuclear capabilities, strategic new capabilities, which can give them opportunity to destroy economy and military power of each other, but only in the nuclear strategic sphere. But what is incomparable are figures of numbers of strategic warheads both countries are having. We are having right now, according to Prague Treaty, we are having a little bit more than 1,500 strategic warheads deployed on the different devices, different types of devices. In the end of Cold War, in 1989, two countries, both of them, had more than 10,000 strategic warheads. So figures are absolutely incomparable. But the essence of relations in the strategic sphere is the same. The capabilities are two countries are having are the same. And Russia is trying to use strategic nuclear forces as an element of balance, military balance, balancing the lack, the deficit of conventional arms which Russia is having in compare, for example, with not only with the United States but with NATO allies. But what is different is motivation. Different are intentions of Soviet military and political elite in the times of Cold War and Russian military and political elite nowadays. Nobody thinks and nobody wants direct military conflict between the United States and Russia, between Russia and NATO countries, because everybody are understanding stakes. Everybody are understanding what could be the result for economies and for societies, for political systems and for the world in general. What is the paradox? That during the Cold War, and I want to emphasize especially on this thesis because it's significant, during the Cold War, both countries had capabilities to destroy each other and to start a massive war with involvement of nuclear forces, but did not have practical intention to do it because nobody in the Soviet Union and not in the United States could think, in the governments of two countries, could think about economic, political and social usage of the territory of potential major adversary after the war. Yes, we could destroy each other, but we didn't have instruments, practical instruments for massive operations on the territory of a major adversary. We didn't have devices and instruments to use medias and other instruments, logistical instruments, to use the territory of principal major adversary after the end of the war. Nobody could even think about it. That's the paradox, the biggest paradox of the Cold War, to my mind. Because, of course, Soviet Union could understand how it could use Western Europe after the hypothetical military conflict. Or, for example, the United States could think how they could use Eastern Europe after or Eastern European part of the Soviet Union in some aspects after a hypothetical war. But the level of destruction, the level of elimination of infrastructure, economic capabilities, military capabilities, and other elements of the goal which could be received in any war can be so dramatic that rational motivation was very low to use military force as the source of resolving the major conflict, as they call, as we can describe the Cold War. Situation right now is absolutely different, because it's the same in some nature, because we do not even think about category in the categories of the direct military conflict. But even if we could hypothetically think in such categories, we cannot imagine what we can do with the territory of each other after the nuclear war, general nuclear war and exchange of nuclear strikes. We do not even know if a civilization of on Earth could exist after the direct nuclear conflict. So what we are entering right now is we're entering to the system of relations, which is based on a permanent political conflict, with at the same time with keeping of economic interdependence, and but with a very low level of economic ties between two countries and their economies. But at the same time, we have no ideological motivation of foreign policy of each other, and no ideological motivation to for confrontation. So it is something different. It's not the Cold War. It's stabilized conflict, stabilized for some years, because not only because of international reasons, and not only because of reasons in bilateral relations, but also stabilized because of domestic political reasons. Domestic political reasons in the United States and domestic political reasons in Russia. What and how this system, which way and how this system will develop? It's the major question, not only for Russian-American relations, but for the whole international system, which is becoming more complicated, more interdependent, and more polycentric. And I want you to think about this question. Thank you.